Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they had no comforter. And I declared that the dead, who had already died, are happier than the living, who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. And I saw that all labour and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbour. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. Again I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friends can help him up, but pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. How can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king, who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were best before them, but those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. This is the word of the Lord.
And if you'd like to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 4, that would be good. And let's just pray before we think about it. Lord God, help us to see your truth. Help us to see Jesus. And help us to see our part in this world. For Jesus' sake. Amen. Now you may think Ecclesiastes is not a very easy book to get to grips with. It's not all gloom and doom, as some may think, nor is it an invitation to eat, drink and be merry for tomorrow we die, as some others have thought. But what it does is depict the realities of this fallen world in which we live. The hardships of it, man's search for meaning and identity and purpose, and it stresses the one fact which we all know, but many fail to take into account. It's transience. Death means that life is like a mist, a vapour, a breath that passes. And what the preacher, the author of Ecclesiastes, says, he's referred to as the preacher, Koheleth in Hebrew, but what he says is this: I don't know all the answers, he says, but he has two main points, and these are really the two main points of the book that you can see reiterated as we go through it. And the first is this: man cannot control his circumstances, his world, or his destiny. And we all want to do that, don't we? We want to control things. We want to make them the best for us and for those we care about. And we are all, to some extent, control freaks, seeking to bend the world to our wishes. But that is actually wanting to be God, isn't it? It's Adam's sin. And we need to recognise that he is in control, and we are limited creatures. And death, of course, stresses the point that there are things way beyond our control. That's the third main point. We are not in control. The thing is this. God has put us in a place where life can be very tough. But because he is God, life is to be lived and enjoyed with him and its center, with everything that he gives, but with account to be given to him. So there's the second point. God at the center. We're not in control. God is. He's at the center. And we live life, all of life, by reference to him. Now, last week, we saw in chapter 3 that the preacher declares that we live in an unfair and unjust world. And he refers to the fact that God has put eternity in the heart of man. His sense that there is justice at the heart of the universe. That what is wrong should be and must be put right. He says he doesn't know how that's going to happen, but he declares his confidence that it will. If you look back to chapter 13, chapter 3, I should say, in verse 15 through to 17, he says, God will call the past to account. And I saw something else. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. And I thought in my heart, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked. So he has this confidence. But what he sees is something entirely different. And in chapter 4, we find at the very beginning him talking once again about the oppression and evil and the feeling of powerlessness that people have in the face of that. What can be done about it? And we find him talking of the effort that goes into life, striving to overcome our circumstances, the isolation that comes when we achieve a measure of success, and the delusion of power and the pressure that this imposes. It seems to me that it strikes a pretty contemporary chord. And he talks of three kinds of people, and they're the three kinds we're going to think about today. The first is the powerless, those who are exploited. The second is the group that I refer to as the strivers, those who are striving to achieve. And the last is the powerful. So the powerless, the strivers, and the powerless. So in verses 1 to 3, he points out the universality of injustice and exploitation of the powerless, who he says twice have no comforter, no hope, no one to protect them, no one to put things right. I saw the oppression that was taking place. I saw the tears of the oppressed. They had no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. No one to protect or put things right. And that, of course, is true of many in the world we inhabit, isn't it? Just read your newspaper. No immediate answer is there to the suffering that is caused by it. And for many, the experience of life is being downtrodden from first to last, taken advantage of, ill-treated, beaten down, and oppressed. No comfort, no hope, no protection. So much so, he says that death is relief. I declare that the dead should already die are happier than the living who are still alive. In fact, he sees the problem is so great that not only are they better off dead than alive under such oppression, but it would have been better if they'd never even been born. Better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun, verse 3. Look around the world. Oppression and exploitation are evident. A common, if not universal, feature of life, of the way humanity is. This isn't a world that is improving, where humans move inexorably towards a utopia, where everything gets better and everybody treats each other right. On the contrary, it's a world where evil appears only too often to prevail. And that's the reality of the condition, the human condition, in this distorted world in which we live. The powerless are powerless. They're exploited. how to make sense of that. And then the second thing, the strider. In verses 4 to 7, he states what is, in fact, pretty obvious if you stop to think about it, that the desire for power and control and success usually stems from envy of those who are powerful, who are masterful, those who appear to have everything sorted and under control. And there's this desire, isn't there, to be that little bit better, to be one up, to get ahead, to be in control. I saw that all labour and all achievement spring to man's envy of his neighbour. This too, he says, is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And Mark has said on a number of occasions that the word meaningless here, translated in the Authorised Version as vanity, is not a good translation. And that's quite clear if you look at the Hebrew. Because the word simply really means transient, passing, fading, evanescent, temporary. And what he's saying is that all the effort that people put in to getting ahead, to try to gain control of life and circumstances, it's like trying to shepherd the wind, because everything is transient. In the end, it gets you nowhere, even if you gain limited power and limited control and limited success for a while. And then, of course, he mentions those who don't even bother to try. Don't bother to strive. They've worked out all this is a complete waste of time. Not going to do anything. He describes them as those who are lazy and indolent, who fold their hands and ruin themselves in verse 5. My father used to say, sorry to quote my father, I've done this before, it's amazing how as one gets older, one finds oneself quoting one's father more and more. But he was often asked at the end of Sunday lunch what he'd like. And he'd say this, he'd say, a little slumber, a little sleep, a little folding of the hands to rest in a most paternalistic manner. But he knew, as you probably do, that that proverb that he quotes goes on in this way. A little slumber, a little sleep, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man. And that's the fool who's folding his hands here and ruining himself. But he points to the opposite end of the scale. The man who simply sets to gain himself, for himself, all that he can, more than what he needs, surplus, excess. He describes that as two handfuls instead of one. Better one handful, he says, with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind, shepherding the wind. He may not run round in circles until he disappears in the proverbial manner, but he doesn't gain peace or tranquility. He's always rushing around to achieve something. So not working, being lazy is bad, but working for work's sake in order to get ahead and control circumstances is not good either. And the preacher points to the changing, the passing nature of human gain, of material human wealth. You're first the man who works to increase his wealth, to buy more and more, to invest more and more, to obtain more and more, but he never has enough. And that's a common feature of those with wealth, isn't it? He's never content, because there's always another deal to be done. There's another thing to possess, another target to aim at, something else to achieve. But when you ask people what they want, they don't say they want money. They say they want security, just enough to feel secure. You see, it's this desire to control circumstances, isn't it? To be in control so that I know that I'm all right for the rest of my life with my pension, whatever it may be. People work to gain security. But there's no security in that. There is never enough. The hamster has to keep the wheel moving. What for? Verse 8, there's a man all alone, he had neither son nor brother, no end to his toil, his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I working, he says? Why am I depriving myself in enjoyment? This is meaningless, it's a miserable business. Who am I doing it for? He may have no one to leave it to, or ungrateful children, I suppose. Anyway, the chance of the exchequer will take it in inheritance tax. Should I spend it on myself, enjoy myself, or keep on striving in case it runs out? And the effect of this is isolation. Loneliness, lack of social contact because of constant effort, constant striving, constantly being caught up in what I'm trying to do, the circumstances I'm trying to control. Remember the rich fool that Jesus speaks of in Luke 12. Tonight, Jesus says in the story, tonight, God says, your soul will be required of you, your life will be taken, you will give account to yourself, and who then will own all these things? It's in God. The business of seeking gains, again said, is miserable. Not much fun so far in this passage, is there? The power, the strivers, and now we come to the powerful, the people you'd have thought ought to be content with where they're at. But what we see in verse 13 to 16 is the delusion of power. It's not an easy passage to understand this part, but it's imagining a king who appears to be propped off, because that's what a king is, right? I think the picture is of a poor but wise youth who becomes a king, but then refuses to take advice once he's conceived it, had it made. He came from poverty or prison, perhaps on a wave of popularity, but that's gone. And there's someone else, another youth, waiting in the wings who wants to take his place. But no sooner will he rise to the height than people will be disillusioned with him as well. Look at verse 15 and 16. The youth may have become from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty with the kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before him. And I think what that means is that there were no end to those who were coming in front of the king with their complaints, their requests, their demands, whatever it may be. It's the very same words that appear back in verse 8. There was no end to his toil. There was no end to the people who came before him. So being a king is quite tough. Being in power is quite tough. It's a tough business being top dog. Everybody wants to take your place, and you're insecure because you think you're going to lose what power you have. Nothing like as much fun as people think. You are insecure, just the same as the powerless and the striver. It's the transient self, shepherding the wind. Always in power, discover that as public winds change and events happen over which they have no control. If there's one thing that COVID has surely brought home to us, it's the fact, isn't it, that we're not in control of our destiny, and the powers that be aren't either. Health, power, and popularity are as transient as material success. Life just isn't fair. And even when things are going well, we know it can't last. It's also ephemeral, isn't it? So transient, evanescent. But there's a positive point in this chapter, which is this. The preacher would like us to see it, and he expresses it, or could be expressed, mathematically. Here's the thought. Zero is better than one. That's what verses 1 to 3 indicate. You're better off never having been born, zero, than being on your own and being oppressed with no one to help. One is better than two. Better one handful with tranquility than excess two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. And then vice versa, two is better than one in verses 9 to 12. Two are better than one, it says expressly, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they'll keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. And lastly, three is better than two. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. And this is really the basic point that the author is trying to get across in chapter 4. We are made by God to live for him and for one another in community. Life is not about getting ahead of the next person. It's not about controlling circumstances. It's not about ourselves as such. It's about enjoying the life that God has given, the work that he's provided for us to do, and the part he wants us to play in community with others. And you also pick this up, I venture to suggest, from chapter 1, verses 24 and 25. I don't mean verses 24 and 25, chapter 1, but actually 2:24 and 25. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This is from the hand of God, for without him, who can eat and find enjoyment? Here it is, putting God at the centre. And chapter 2, verse 22, I saw there's nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that is his lot. That's what God has given him to do. The critical point is that we see this as coming from the hand of God and respond to him. And in chapter 4, it's doing that in cooperation with others and for the benefit of others, for society, for community as a whole. We're born to live with each other and work and help one another. And that was the point of the opening passages I read from Genesis chapter 1 and 2, or 2 and 3. And if you go on and read through the first 11 chapters of Genesis, what we see is the practice that occurs in society when man rejects God. Division between husband and wife, Adam and Eve. Division between brother and brother, Cain and Abel. Division between families and clans. Division between nation and nation, the Tower of Babel, and so on. It's a society which becomes more and more fractured the further we move away from God. And what verse 9 through to 12 tells us is that working with others for mutual benefit is good. That's what work is about. To bring God's creation into the order for which it was designed, and to do it with other people, working for the common good. People miss the social aspect of going to work during COVID, but the point is much wider than that. It's working for the common good that's in contemplation here. And for those at work, they need to see the part that their work plays in the biggest picture of society. What is the contribution that is being made? And for those who are not at work, I want to see what their contribution in terms of family, social life, and everything else is within society. And in the hardships of life, we're helped. A good return to work, much better to work in a team, in cooperation with others. If one falls down, friends can help them up. We're there to help one another when things get tough. We share the disappointments and pain and hardships of life. We share warmth when cold. And we find that one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves, we can stand in combination together against what is evil and oppression. And three is better than two. God said to Adam, it's not good. It's not good for man to be alone. He gave him hope. But beyond the two, the three brings greater strength. And the Trinity itself is an indication of the primacy of relationship. Relationship between God, the Father, Son, and Spirit. Relationship between his people. And from a New Testament perspective, we can see this again. The people of God is a very important concept in the Old Testament. But in our individualistic society in the West, where my rights and my entitlement and my self-fulfillment is considered a priority, we need to grasp the fact, the communal aspect of God's requirements. We need to recapture that. in the context of church life, God's people, but in the context of life more generally. Looking at paid work jobs, family functions, whatever it is, all of life, to see it as part of God's big picture. God's design for humanity of taking care and working the ground, as it's put, being fruitful, filling the earth, subduing it, being under control and order. For whom? For God, because it's a God-given task. And for the benefit of mankind. That's what he commanded Adam and Noah to do. And so we see all of life as this gift from God. Something we can't control, something we're given, a task to undertake, a part to play. To do it in community. And for our work and roles in life to be seen as what God has given us specifically to do with him and with others. Not working for ourselves, not living for ourselves, not seeking power, not trying to control everything, not looking for security in the things that we can control and do, but living for him and trusting him. And in case you didn't get the point of the reading that we have from Mark, here we find two of Jesus' disciples trying to get ahead of all the rest, don't we? They go to Jesus and say, we want to be top dogs in your kingdom. What is number two and number three? At your right hand and at your left when you're king. And what does Jesus say? That's not for me to give you. That's something for God to sort out, God the Father. He's in control. But anybody who wants to be great amongst you must be your servant. Jesus has to put them right. Because God isn't there to help us to get ahead of others, or to control the things that are around about us. Our prayers are often direct, that aren't they? Lord, just sort things out the way I want them to be. And that's not what it's about, is it? We're here to serve, and to serve him in community. Bear these words. Whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Shall we pray? Lord, destroy our little delusion, our pathetic attempt to control life and circumstances. Help us to trust you, to see the part that you have given us to play, to put you at the centre, enjoy the good things you have given, and live life to the full in reliance upon you. For Jesus' sake we ask it. Amen.